From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with disaster relief expert Fred Cuny about the humanitarian needs in Chechnya. Cuny just returned from a month there where he talked with civilians who were trapped by the fighting and with military and civilian officials on both sides. Also today, the strange power that can come with affliction. We talk with neurologist Oliver Sacks. The author of The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat and Awakenings has a new book about some of the remarkable patients he works with. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Stock markets in Asia and London plunged today after the collapse of Britain's oldest investment bank over the weekend. NPR's Andy Bowers reports.
The Baring Brothers Bank, established in 1762 and home to such prestigious clients as Queen Elizabeth, appears to have been brought down by the unauthorized actions of a single employee. 28-year-old Singapore-based trader Nicholas Leeson lost around $800 million gambling on the future price of the Tokyo stock market. Those losses grew today as the Nikkei fell on the news of Baring's collapse. Over the weekend, the Bank of England stepped in to try to find companies willing to bail out Baring's, but it failed to do so before Asian stock markets opened for business this morning. Baring's was one of the most respected investment banks in Asia, and its collapse is sending shockwaves throughout the global financial markets. The Times of London reports that trader Nicholas Leeson has not been seen since Thursday. I'm Andy Bowers in London.
Meanwhile, the Dow has fallen below the psychological 4,000 mark, but analysts say that's because of profit-taking after last week's rally. The French government says it will set up a diplomatic mission in Baghdad, despite opposition from Britain and the United States. France favors easing United Nations sanctions against Iraq. Lynn Terry reports from Paris.
Foreign Ministry spokesman Richard Duquet said the French diplomatic mission in Baghdad, which is being established in the Romanian embassy there, will open tomorrow. He said a French diplomat will head a small staff, which will mainly handle administrative issues. France has justified the move, saying both Britain and the United States have diplomatic contacts with Iraq. However, France has clashed with its partners over easing sanctions against Baghdad. France and Russia want the oil embargo against Iraq suspended. Britain and the United States do not, and the U.S. ambassador is currently touring other members of the U.N. Security Council to convince them that the oil embargo should be maintained when the sanctions are reviewed in April. For National Public Radio, I'm Lynn Terry in Paris.
State and local officials are getting ready for the Pentagon's newest list of proposed military base closures. A draft list has gone to Defense Secretary William Perry. Some bases on the hit list were leaked over the weekend. They're in Texas, Mississippi, Massachusetts, and Pennsylvania, although Texas seems to be the hardest hit. Massachusetts Governor William Weld says he won't run for the Republican presidential nomination. He told a news conference in Boston today running for president would make him an absentee father and an absentee governor. He's hinted he could accept the vice presidential spot on a GOP ticket. So far, Texas Senator Phil Graham is the only official Republican candidate for president. Former Tennessee Governor Lamar Alexander is to formally announce his candidacy tomorrow. Senate Majority Leader Bob Dole is expected to announce next month. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average has fallen almost 24 points to 3987. This is NPR. President Clinton has made it easier for the federal government to fine parents who are federal workers and owe child support. He signed an executive order directing federal agencies to help track down some 105,000 federal workers who owe child support. The main aim of the new rule will be to seek improved communication between states and the federal government. Officials say violators can slip through the cracks between jurisdictions. About 3% of military workers and 1.3% of civilian federal workers are thought to be deadbeat parents. A prominent Minneapolis street gang leader, Sharif Willis, was found guilty today of federal weapons and drug charges. Willis is the former head of United for Peace, a gang coalition that opposed violence. John Bewin of Minnesota Public Radio has this report.
A federal jury found Willis guilty on three counts of illegally possessing firearms and cocaine. The charges stemmed from an incident last October at a Minneapolis service station. Willis allegedly held 11 people at gunpoint during an argument over repair work on his car. Willis maintained he walked innocently into an altercation between others at the station. Willis, a leader of the Vice Lords gang, gained national attention for his efforts to unite street gangs against violence, but he fell out of grace with the Minneapolis Police Department after Vice Lords members close to Willis were convicted of murdering a Minneapolis police officer in 1992. The 43-year-old Willis faces a minimum of 20 years in prison. His previous felony convictions include murder and armed robbery. For National Public Radio, this is John Biewen in St. Paul.
NASA is starting the countdown for Thursday's launch of the space shuttle Endeavour. 7 astronauts are scheduled to crew the longest planned space shuttle mission yet. They'll aim telescopes at hundreds of celestial objects during their flight, from the moon to a distant quasar more than 10 billion light-years away. I'm Corva Coleman, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Last night, disaster relief expert Fred Cuny returned to the United States from a month in Chechnya, where the war rages on. Since December, Russia has used air power and ground troops to prevent the largely Muslim republic from seceding. Much of the capital city, Grozny, is in ruins. Cuny's mission was to evaluate humanitarian needs in Chechnya, as well as to assess where the war is heading and what can be done to end the fighting. He went on behalf of the Open Society Institute, which is funded by the Soros Foundation. Cuny has done disaster relief work since the 1969 Biafran War. Recently, he directed the rebuilding of water and gas lines in Sarajevo, which he discussed with us on his previous visit to Fresh Air. Cuny is the founding president of the Intertect Relief and Reconstruction Corporation in Texas. Earlier today, I asked him how much fighting there is in Chechnya now.
Quite a bit. The Chechens still hold a large portion of the city exclusively. They control the areas that are south of the river. They have a large segment of about a quarter of the city that they control entirely. But they can move any place in the city they want. They have routes in and out of the city from the south. They have ways to reach the northern parts of the city where there's a large Russian military presence. And they virtually control the city, despite the fact that the Russians have about 30,000 troops there.
Before we get into some of the specifics, maybe you could give us just a broad overview of what you found.
Well, certainly from an immediate point of view, the biggest single problem is the number of civilians who are still trapped in the southern, southeastern parts of the city. The Chechens are ironically fighting a war in the city to protect a Russian population from Russian bombing. The people who are left are essentially Russian ethnic origin or other Slavic groups. They are elderly. I'd say probably 90% are 70 years or older. They are people who were retired pensioners, people who lived in what they call the internats or the welfare homes for the elderly, who couldn't escape. All the Chechens that were there have long gone, and the way the battle unfolded, there was a corridor that was left to the south of the city for people to evacuate, and the Chechens took all their people and left. And so you have now a small number of fighters that are still in the area that are fighting the Russians and pinning them down and making them pay a penalty for being there. But the civilians that are left in that area are all Russians or Slavs who are increasingly becoming vulnerable to the situation. There's no water, there's no gas or heat, no light. Food supplies are minimal, and things are beginning to deteriorate very rapidly for these people. They need to be evacuated.
Did you interview any of the ethnic Russians who are trapped in Grozny, and what kinds of stories did they tell you about how the military, the Russian military, has been treating the remaining civilians?
Yes, I interviewed about 200 people that were living in the various shelters. They live in sort of three different types of accommodations. The people who were living in large apartment complexes, the buildings have been destroyed, but the basements are intact. And you have large numbers of people living in the basements. You also have people living in the old civil defense bomb shelters that were built during the Cold War era. And in some ways, they're the ones who are the best off because the bomb shelters are quite deep and you get some insulation from the earth that's above them. But there's no way to heat them because they're not very well ventilated. So at night they have to seal everything up, and the temperatures are still very cold, but they're not freezing. The people who are living in the bombed out buildings are much closer to the surface, and it's harder to keep the buildings warm. There are a lot of leaks, and often the temperatures are below freezing in those. And you have a third group that are living in bombed out factories. And the reason they've chosen the factories is they can go into the buildings and get between the machinery, and the machinery provides some protection from fragmentation when the bombs go off. Of all the groups, they're probably the worst off. And those are the areas, actually, where we have a number of children that are in the area. Those kind of facilities have more children than the others. But again, I want to stress that most of the people there are old and elderly, former pensioners or pensioners and former veterans that are caught there and not able to leave. The situation is such that they don't really come into contact with the Russian military directly. The Chechens hold a line of confrontation and prevent the Russian army from coming into the area. So what happens is the Russians basically bomb the city. They use aircraft and heavy artillery. And the way the war has been unfolding is the Chechens have had small teams that have been able to control the intersections and the roads and fire from buildings, and so the Russians have responded by destroying the buildings. So what's happening is, you know, block by block, the city's being reduced to rubble.
It must be very eerie in the city now, since a lot of it is destroyed. There's still a lot of fighting going on, and most of the people are living in subterranean places.
It is very, very eerie. I've been on both sides of the lines. We managed to get into the northern part with some people who were being asked to return to the city by the Russians. The Russian government has been telling people that the city is now secure and that people can go back, and they've organized buses to bring them back. So I actually hopped on one of these buses and went with the people back to the city. And what we found, of course, is that the minute we got there, people saw the extent of the damages, learned there was no food, no water, and they got back on the bus and left. So very few of the people who came down are staying. Nobody lives above ground. Even on the government-occupied areas, the areas that the Russians have a large military presence, they have virtually no control over those sections of the city. The Chechen fighters can pop up from the sewers anytime and shoot. There's still shelling that goes on back from in retaliation across the lines. The Russian soldiers are extremely scared. They get into the areas that they're holding, build small foxholes and protective settlements, and then hunker down and hope that nobody shoots them.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Fred Cuny. He's the founder of Intertact, which is an emergency management consulting firm, and he just returned from Chechnya, where he spent about a month assessing the humanitarian situation there for the group Open Society. Now, I believe that you toured Grozny with Chechen forces and with Russian forces, is that right?
That's correct. The first time I went in, I met with some Chechen leaders. They reluctantly agreed to take me in with them. We slipped through the Russian lines at night. In the process, we could see Russian tanks on either side of us, and but managed to go right through the middle of the lines and got to their headquarters inside Grozny, and then I spent time with them going through the city, and they were showing us that, in fact, they could, in fact, get anywhere they wanted to go and that they could move without too much difficulty.
How do they do it, could you say?
Well, they've got all sorts of ways of moving. A large number of their movements are through the tunnels that are under the city. Crossing the river is the most dangerous thing because you're exposed during that time, so that's done largely at night. They slip across, you know, one at a time, very stealthily. There are some other ways that they have, which I don't want to mention, but they have some routes in. Once on the Russian side, they just simply move from abandoned building to abandoned building, often going through basements or through these tunnels that connected the buildings. They go through buildings that appear to have collapsed, and they've created their own little entrances and exits, and they can move right across the city very quickly without too much difficulty.
Did both sides try to convince you of their justness in the war?
Oh, of course. But
what are some of the things they each told you justifying their side?
Well, the Chechens, to them, it's just a straight issue of independence. They feel that they were never a part of Russia, that the Federation is an artificial concoction that came out of the collapse of the Soviet Union. They argue that they were an occupied territory that's been in constant revolt ever since they joined or were captured back in the 1860s, and that they have a legitimate right to be independent. And that's it. It's a strictly black and white issue on their side. On the Russian side, it's you know, there are many different fears that the Russians have. One is that this could be the beginning of a breakdown of Russia, that they have to deal with the issue of minorities in Russia, and that they can't simply allow one republic to go, because then, you know, any group could get together, create sort of a border and say, you know, it's theirs and they want out, and that this would leave Russia strapped of resources and rapidly shrinking territory, and one that would be largely at war with itself. So those are the kind of concerns that the Russians expressed to us on their side. And there's validity, of course, in both positions. The question is, you know, how do you resolve these issues? And certainly the answer is not by trying to destroy the city and kill all these people.
My guest is disaster relief and reconstruction expert Fred Cuny. He's just returned from a month in Chechnya. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with disaster relief expert Fred Cuny, who's just returned from Chechnya. This doesn't seem to be a very popular war in Russia. I've read about desertions in the Russian army and mothers trying to track down their sons and get them out of the war. Was there a lot of unhappiness among the Russian soldiers that you spoke with?
Oh, the Russian soldiers are really in a bind on this. The average soldier does not want to be there. They realize that they're being poorly led. They're not well supplied. There are food shortages or water shortages on the part of the Russian military. It's clear that their tactics have not worked. They blame the senior commanders for getting them into this. But on the ground, there have been very little in the way of desertions. But what you have is this incredible phenomena. I haven't seen anything like this anywhere else, where the families, the mothers, have begun putting pressure on the military to let their sons go. And mothers get on train and go down to the military headquarters, get a pass, and then go over and grab the sons and pull them out of the army. And the army lets them go. There's a large rate of desertion of people who are being sent to Grozny. And soldiers get off trains, or they desert at their bases before they get sent to the battle site. And the Russian army has responded by setting up an office in Moscow where the deserters can go and be reassigned to other units without prejudice. So you have, obviously within the army and the military structure in general, a real reluctance to get involved in this war. Some of it is because they think it's the wrong war. Others, they're not prepared to fight this war. Others, because they're afraid of what it's going to do to the military. There are many different agendas that the military itself has for not being involved in this. But on the ground, many of the senior commanders are opposed to the war, but they're prosecuting it very vigorously because they're following orders. So it's a really mixed bag. It's hard to find a motivation that's uniform throughout the military on this.
What are you going to recommend the priority should be for human rights?
Well, we think that the major thing that needs to be done is to help evacuate the people. We think that the people who are remaining there are Russian. They all want to leave. Most have places they could go until the situation stabilizes. And we think it's extremely important that pressures be put on the Russian government to recognize that the people that they're likely to kill are going to be these very innocent old people who they're going to die one way or the other. Either going to die in the collapse of buildings as the Russians continue to bomb those areas, or they're going to die from, you know, lack of food and exposure because they can't move and go anyplace else, and supplies and are running out, and they just their ability to withstand these conditions over long periods of time just isn't there.
What would it take to get them out?
Well, we think an evacuation could be organized by the Russian authorities. There's a ministry for special emergency situations that has lots of capabilities, and they've got trucks and buses and so forth, and they could certainly handle the evacuation without too much difficulty. It's just a matter of getting a ceasefire to make that happen. And what we're hoping is that the international community will step in and encourage the government of Russia to create this ceasefire and to get the people out of there.
Will there be other recommendations?
Well, we have some that are specific to the work of the organizations that are there. For example, we're working with a surgical group there to provide additional surgical support in some of the frontline medical centers, along with other groups such as the International Committee of the Red Cross and Médecins Sans Frontières. That's a French group. We've also made recommendations on how to improve the shelter situation in Ingushetia. We want to help improve the registration system in conjunction with work being done by the International Organization for Migration. There are a number of specific activities that we would like to support with the small amount of money that we have available. But these are decisions that have not been made yet. We're simply making these as recommendations to the Open Society Institute and to see what it wants to fund.
Is there any end in sight to the fighting?
I don't see it right away. It's going to be a long time before they really have any effective control over the city. The Chechens don't have a large force in the city. It's probably no more than about 1,500 hardcore fighters. And so it's very easy for them to set up small hit teams that move around the town. And the way the Russians respond to the shooting is to level the buildings. And they can continue to level buildings all day long, but the Chechens can still move through the rubble fairly easily. They don't have to resupply a large number of people. If they lose a dozen men a day, it's easy to infiltrate those guys through the lines and rebuild their forces on the inside of the city and just to keep on hitting the Russians. One of the Russian general officers who's in the commandant's office in Grozny, and I had a discussion. I said, you know, what's next? Where are you going to go after you get out of Grozny? He said, we're never going to get out of Grozny.
Well, it sounds like if the war does end, or when the war does end, that the city will have to be nearly totally rebuilt.
Absolutely. They're going to have to start over from scratch. So many of the tactics that the Russians are using are counterproductive. For example, they know the Chechens move through these tunnels and these conduits. So what they have to do to stop and reduce their mobility is to blow them up. But if you blow up the conduits, you can't run the water system. Without the water system, nobody's going to come back to the city. So they're really caught in the old Vietnam syndrome. You have to destroy the city in order to save it. And the general officers on the ground know that this is a problem, and they're sitting there shaking their heads. You know, how do we bring this thing to an end without creating such a situation that they can never reoccupy the city?
And, of course, it's to the Russian advantage for the Chechens to come back to Grozny.
For the Chechens to come back to Grozny, but as long as the Russians are there, they won't come back. The only way they'll come back is as fighters to attack the Russians.
My guest is Fred Cuny, and he's the founder and president of Intertect Relief and Reconstruction Corporation, which provides emergency management consultation. And he's just returned from Chechnya, where he was analyzing the humanitarian situation for a group called the Open Society Institute. Fred Cuny, the last time we spoke about a year and a half ago, you were working on restoring gas and water to Sarajevo. What's the status of the gas and water lines that you installed there?
The gas project has gone now into another phase. It's being handled by the International Rescue Committee and supported by the U.S. AID, Agency for International Development. And I'd say that the gas project is probably one of the most successful projects in Sarajevo. We've installed now almost 80,000 meters of gas mains and easily another 100,000 meters of pipes to connect people to the houses. and virtually no one is in Sarajevo is going to die of exposure or lack of heat as long as the gas keeps coming. The water system is complete. Water is coming into the city. We've had a real hard time with the local authorities on some of the keeping the plants going, mainly because there's a dispute about what kind of standards the water system should meet and the difficulty of actually proving those under combat conditions. But the water is going into the city, and it's providing about 60% of all the water that's going into the town now.
Did your work in Sarajevo help you in evaluating what's happening in Chechnya?
Yes, it did. It gave a really solid frame of reference to the needs of urban populations. And one of the most interesting things for me in terms of comparing Sarajevo to Grozny was the difference that aerial bombing made of the city compared to Sarajevo. In Sarajevo, we established the no-fly zone, which is enforced by NATO, which has kept the Serbian bombers and fighter planes with bombs from attacking the city. And what that has meant is that we could do the water project because only the heavy bombs break up the water mains that run underneath the ground. In Grozny, where you had the penetration bombs and attempts to blow up buildings with big, heavy 500-kilogram bombs and so on, those destroyed the water system, destroyed the gas system. There was no way that you could get water in, so you have to go on using tankers to deliver water on the surface. And, of course, nobody wants to be outside and drive a tanker through town with all the fighting going on. So the real difference has been if you can keep the airplanes out of the bombing equation, you have a chance of delivering water and keeping the city municipal systems relatively intact.
You have a private consulting and relief and reconstruction company. You've worked with the UN, you've worked with the Red Cross, you've worked with the Soros Foundation, which is a private foundation. Do you think that the role of governments and private foundations and businesses is shifting in relationship to the civil wars that we're seeing?
Well, I think right now there's a lot of rethinking about the whole international system. Clearly, the system is not working very well. It's really a collection of ad hoc organizations that are trying to accomplish a number of goals, each with their own agendas. And there have been real difficulties in places like Bosnia, where the issue of neutrality has become an obstacle rather than a facilitating environment. The role of peacekeeping troops, the fact that we have peacekeepers who are sent to an area with no mandate to protect people, but only to protect relief operations, is ludicrous. And I think the whole issue of whether we get into peace enforcement or peacemaking versus peacekeeping is a question that needs to really be looked at very, very heavily.
Fred Cuny is the founding president of the Intertect Relief and Reconstruction Corporation in Texas, which consults with voluntary and governmental agencies as well as the UN. He returned from his trip to Chechnya last night. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional funding is provided by Living Language. Learn a new language at home or on the go with Living Language. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, the story of the artist who became colorblind and the blind man whose vision was restored after 40 years. We talk with neurologist Oliver Sacks about the patients who are the subject of his new book, An Anthropologist on Mars. Sacks is also the author of Awakenings and The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat. Oliver Sacks, coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. President Clinton has signed an executive order giving the federal government more power to track down federal workers who aren't paying child support. Mr. Clinton says this will help force deadbeat parents to pay the back monies that they owe. He had this warning.
Any parent who is avoiding his or her child support should listen carefully. We will find you. We will catch you. We will make you pay.
It's estimated more than 100,000 federal workers now owe back child support, most of them in the military. Supporters of the balanced budget amendment are trying to persuade Georgia Senator Sam Nunn to join them. Amendment supporters say they have 66 Senate votes to pass the amendment. 67 are needed to forward the amendment to the states for ratification. Utah Senator Orrin Hatch says hasty last-minute efforts are underway to entice Nunn to support the amendment.
Today, I've sent to Senator Nunn a personal letter, a brief on this issue, a letter from Congressman Gingrich, the Speaker, a letter from Senator Dole, both saying that they would pass this legislation in a very quick time, and a copy of a bill that would solve every problem that Senator Nunn has raised.
Nunn worries that the amendment will let federal courts take on active enforcement roles if Congress fails to balance the budget. He says that could put congressional tax and appropriation policies in the hands of judges. A new report from the International Narcotics Control Board says international drug traffickers are cooperating more. The BBC's Kathy Jenkins reports now there's an increase in the worldwide drug production and use.
It points to an increasing cooperation between traffickers, with so-called joint ventures involving Latin American cartels, European and African drug trafficking groups, and organized crime rings from Russia and Eastern Europe. Also to a diversification of trafficking routes. For example, the shipping of cocaine from Latin America to countries such as Moldova, Russia, and Ukraine. Not necessarily for use in those countries, but for forwarding to Western Europe. The report describes Africa as a weak link in the drug control system because it provides the most legal loopholes. 14 African countries are not yet party to any of the three major drug control treaties. In summing up, the report says that better implementation of the existing treaties, rather than new ones, is a key to more effective international control.
Pentagon officials say the main marine landing is now underway in Somalia. They're protecting the last of the UN peacekeepers who are leaving the country. The Marines are helping to end 2 years of an operation that many say has failed. The United Nations is trying to restore order in Somalia after its president was ousted and warring clans battled for control. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 24 points today. This is NPR. Tighter security measures went into effect today at one of the high schools in East St. Louis, Illinois. The state took over the financial management of the troubled school district. NPR's Kathy Lohr reports.
After fights, a pellet gun shooting, a stabbing, and a teacher being knocked down in the hallway, all in the last few weeks, teachers at East St. Louis Senior High called in sick and demanded better security. Their action worked for one school. Beginning today, students must use photo IDs to get into the building. Metal detectors and surveillance cameras are also being installed. Earl Solomon is a social studies teacher.
I believe that the district has done what is reasonable under the circumstances. The problem is, there are many other schools in the district, junior high and high school, which have no or little or inadequate security protection.
How the district will pay for the extra security, even in one school, is unclear. Officials have been cutting programs to come up with a balanced budget, and there are already plans to lay off about 200 employees. I'm Kathy Lohr in St. Louis.
About three-fourths of the city workers in Washington, D.C. have the day off. They're taking a day without pay as part of the city's efforts to deal with a projected $720 million budget deficit. The city says only some 9,000 to 41,000 workers are on the clock today. D.C. Mayor Marion Barry plans to have 10 furlough days in all, hoping to generate some $30 million in savings. A regional leader from the Osetia region of Russia is worried that the separatist war in Chechnya could spread across the Caucasus Mountains to his region. There's been gunfire between Osetians and troops from Ingushetia. They are neighboring regions of Chechnya who have their own dispute. A Russian deputy prime minister is traveling to Chechnya. He's expected to look at ways of reviving the Chechen economy. But rather Russian big guns are still pounding rebel fighters in the region. Russian troops hope to control Grozny this week. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR, in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Neurologist Oliver Sacks studies disorders of the brain to understand more about how the human brain works and what makes us human. His patients have disorders like Tourette syndrome, autism, and amnesia. He's discovered that neurological problems often have the paradoxical role of bringing out latent creative powers. He writes, the study of disease demands the study of identity, the inner worlds that patients under the spur of illness create. Dr. Sacks is best known for his books that describe those inner worlds through case studies. Those books are The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat and Awakenings, which was adapted into a film starring Robin Williams as Dr. Sacks. In his new book, An Anthropologist on Mars, Dr. Sacks writes about a patient who's an artist who became colorblind after an auto accident. Dr. Sacks calls him Jonathan I.
He was driving to a studio the day after the accident, and everything looked gray and bleached, although he knew that it was a bright, sunny day. And when he got there, his paintings, which were brilliantly colored, he was an abstract expressionist who was really famous for his use of color, were all sort of drained of color and in a sense of meaning and feeling for him. And he was aghast. And he went home, and his wife was a sort of an animated gray statue, as he described it. And he himself was gray, and the notion of gray flesh, touching gray flesh, sort of horrified him. And memory and imagination didn't help, as happens in this sort of situation when the color-constructing parts of the brain are knocked out. You not only lose the ability to perceive color, but to imagine it or remember it. Sort of the neural idea of color is deleted. And this was a terrible time for him at first, because he found himself in a very ugly, impoverished world, and one which was sort of drained of meaning.
You know what I found? That losing his sense of color affected every aspect of his life. It affected what he wanted to eat. You say he only wanted to eat black and white foods like yogurt or rice or black olives.
Right. Well, anything else just looked terribly wrong for him. And it's his dog looked terribly wrong. And he wanted to get a black and white dog.
I think what helped me get a sense of what he was going through was a painting of his that you reproduce in the book. And it's a still life of apples, oranges, bananas, but it's all in blacks and grays, with the exception of one orange that has its true color in the center of the painting. And the black banana, it's grotesque, it's nauseating.
Well, this was certainly how he found it. These fruits which he made were actually part of a whole gray universe which he made in his studio. It was a sort of a room with a banqueting table and a dinner laid out, and to try and show us what it was like. One of the things which had vexed him was people said, well, so you don't see color, no big deal, what the hell, you know. And it was in a way to try and convey the enormity of it that these sort of gruesome artifacts were produced.
What's so surprising about this story is that slowly his experience was redefined. What started off being really grotesque and nauseating to him became more natural.
Well, indeed, this was very remarkable. When he came to see me, I first sort of tried to define the damage as much as I could, and it was clear that there were two small areas in the back of the brain and the visual cortex which had been knocked out, areas which are sometimes called the colour-constructing areas. I didn't know whether they would ever recover, and I hoped he might sort of start to feel less horrified by this world. But as you say, in fact, the opposite happened, and gradually what had been so horrible took on a sort of beauty for him, and he reconstituted his world, or his world reconstituted itself in black and white, but again with the meaning and the feeling and the coherence and the artistic possibilities restored to it. And he started painting again, and people remarked on the extraordinary power of this new black and white art. Very few of them knew that there'd been a neurological accident behind it. But it's this moving, losing one world, but then being able to recreate the world and oneself and in other terms, which was so striking with him, and in a sense, I suppose, becomes one of the themes of the book.
When you stopped seeing him, where did you leave things with him in terms of your diagnosis and prognosis?
Well, in terms of the diagnosis, he had knocked out these two small areas, which are called V4 in the brain, probably from a vascular accident, and I doubted if there would be any recovery. By that time, he had been launched on his art and again on his life, and didn't seem to be repining too much and no longer seemed to be yearning too much for colour. In the early days, he would glare at oranges and trying to restore them to their, in imagination, to their proper colour. And now he seemed very much at home, and even, I think, felt that he was in a rather privileged world of subtle tone and texture, and that the rest of us were sort of subject to sort of a chromatic distractedness. And there was one point when a colleague of mine thought of a way by which it might have been possible to reprogram other parts of the brain to construct colour. And at that point he said, I would have loved you if you could have done this earlier, but now, he said, I don't want it anymore. My world is complete without colour.
My guest is neurologist Oliver Sacks. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. You're just joining us. My guest is neurologist Oliver Sacks. He has a new book called An Anthropologist on Mars. There's a story that's a really, really fascinating counterpart to the story of the artist who was colorblind. And this is the story of a man who was blind for 45 years, and then his sight was restored. And he had incredible difficulties adapting to having his sight.
Yes, this was Virgil, and I first learned of him. You know, many of the stories, cases here have started with a letter or a phone call, out of the blue. And here the phone call was saying, this man, blind since infancy, had surgery and his sight was restored, and now he sees everything, but he recognizes nothing. And, hell, what's going on?
Well, what was going on? Is that typical, that if somebody has a sense restored or given to them for the first time in their life, that they can't make anything coherent out of it?
Well, I think this is typical, and I think perhaps it might have been anticipated. But this is a very rare situation. There have really been no more than perhaps 15 or 20 such cases described since the early 18th century, although interestingly, precisely this was described in 1728, in a blind boy from whom the cataracts were couched. But the immediate notion, and the notion you have in the Bible and in fairy stories, is that vision will be restored. And it was thought here that Virgil would have the operation. It might fail completely, but it might work, and he would say, you know, hallelujah, I can see again. And what happened wasn't at all like that. When the bandages were unwound, he saw a blur of movement and colour, which was chaotic, which made no sense. And it was only when his surgeon spoke that he thought to himself, voices come from faces, that blur must be a face. But it wasn't a coherent percept for him. He had no visual concept of a face. And this was his introduction, really, to a world of deep chaos in some ways, and the chaos of a man and a brain which hadn't learnt to see, which didn't know how to deal with this new input from the eyes.
So instead of the fairy tale happy ending where he shouts, hallelujah, my sight is restored, was he sorry that he had his sight restored?
Well, it was complex and mixed, because there were also some positive experiences. He was in fact delighted by movement and by colour, and he started to recognise various things. And it was certainly an adventure for him. But it was also a terrible challenge and stress, and one which I think was too much for him. And so increasingly he would often close his eyes or turn off the light and long for this secure world of touch and the other senses in which he felt at home.
This story has a very unusual twist to it. He ended up losing his sight again. What happened?
Well, in a way which I think might have was sort of a bit uncanny. And it happened soon, you know, at a time when he seemed to be turning a corner and really beginning to get used to the world of sight. He developed a bad pneumonia and almost died. This knocked out the respiratory center in his brain, and so the levels of oxygen in his blood fell very low. When they fell low, he would become completely blind again, and then he would recover some sight as the levels went up. But then, with this situation continuing, what sight he had and the visual world which he had achieved sort of disappeared again, and he once again became blind, and completely blind, and in a way blinder than he had ever been before, because his retina, in effect, got destroyed. And what exactly happened, I don't know, but I would suspect that these very abnormal blood gases must have played a part. It was an uncanny twist, but one which his wife and doctor, some people saw with horror. He himself, I think, was not entirely horrified, and it may have sort of released him from an impossible fight. I have to say that since then he has lost a good deal of weight, and he is no longer on oxygen, and I'm told there is some sight again, and I have to see him, and there may be a postscript to this piece sooner or later.
Yeah, you also write that disorders and disease can play a paradoxical role by bringing out latent powers and creative potential. I guess that relates in a way to Jonathan Eye, the artist who became colorblind and started to work with that and do paintings that were acclaimed.
Yes, well, his sort of creative powers were there, but they were able to sort of flow into a new channel. But sometimes I think that an affliction alone can bring out something quite unexpected. I see this in many different ways. Something I didn't describe in the book, but it just comes into my mind. I have a patient, a very nice woman, who became quadriplegic in an accident. But now every morning she is able to look at the New York, the Times crossword, to consign the entire crossword to memory and then solve it mentally in the course of the day. She said she could never have done this before she became ill, but this sort of strange power just came to her.
My guest is neurologist Oliver Sacks. He'll be back in a minute. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Noah, what do you have on the big bank collapse in England?
Hi, Terry. Andy Bowers reports from London on the failure of one of the old line firms there. It's called Barings. Part of the problem involved the Japanese stock market. Other news, Anne Gerrell's reports from close to Grozny, where the small towns are still in Chechen hands and they're in danger of falling to the Russian forces. Cheryl Duvall reports in the Democratic primary tomorrow in Chicago. Five convicted felons are among the many candidates for city council in Chicago. And John Itzde outlines the best arguments for and against the idea of a balanced budget amendment in the United States.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. My guest is neurologist Oliver Sacks. His new book of case studies is called An Anthropologist on Mars. Dr. Sacks grew up in a medical family. Both of his parents were doctors. Why did you choose neurology as your area of specialization?
I think it was partly in the family, in the family conversation. Both parents had trained in neurology, although neither of them stayed in neurology. I think partly when I was very young, I used to have severe blinding migraines. Indeed, I confess I have one at the moment.
Do you really?
Well, it's a mild one. But then, as it were, part of a vision to the left, usually, or half the visual field would disappear, or sometimes it might be drained of colour, as happened with Jonathan Eye. So I think I got a very early sense that that the world was only given to one by courtesy of the brain. But this, you know, people talk about the three-pound universe and in the head. You know, I've loved and still love all the other sciences. And I'm happy to revert to them and sort of walk in the botanical garden and botanize. But finally, the brain is infinitely more than any leaf or kidney. It's the most complex object in the universe, and this object which makes possible a subject, and our subjective life of feeling and mind and religious strivings and sensibility. And it's the most enormous, wonderful mystery. And I think it was clear to me from the age of 13 or 14 that that's probably what I wanted to look at.
When you have a migraine like you do now, do you have any appetite for discussing your work or doing your work? How much are you disabled by the pain and other side effects of the migraine?
It was bad about an hour ago. but it's not bad now. Amongst other things, I'm partly fascinated by migraines, and I think having migraines myself was one of the things which incited me to my own first book, which was on migraine. So there's some part of me which always sort of, you know, uses it to investigate things, but I think this migraine is also saying to me, you've been up and doing one thing and another since 5 this morning and really almost nonstop for 3 days, and you better take it easy for I'm partly conscious of the migraine as a sort of strategy of the organism.
Tell me what else you've learned from your own migraines. I hope it's not making the pain worse to dwell on this.
No.
But, I mean, we all get headaches, some of us worse than others. And I just find when I have a headache, it's difficult to concentrate. It's difficult to really enjoy life. Sometimes I feel like, well, gee, my whole worldview is dependent on hormones and neurological pathways. Do I have a headache? You know, what are my hormones like today? And you feel like, shouldn't I be able to transcend this? You know, haven't I been like alive long enough that I could just transcend all of that and be in a good mood no matter what? Yeah, go ahead.
Well, yeah. Now, for example, Freud had bad migraines. And he spoke of some of the difficulties that he would have difficulty remembering proper names in migraines and sometimes complex actions. But he felt he could rise above it, and damn it, it wouldn't stop him from doing anything. He said the same about the colds and influenzas he got, and he said the same about the terrible cancer of the jaw, which tormented him in the last 17 years or so of his life. I mean, one does rise above these things all the while, and yet the other side of this is that in another way, perhaps, the imagination is limited by what's going on with the body. For example, and I describe this in a leg to stand on, in my autobiographical book about being a patient myself, when the nerve supply to and from one of my legs was really quite badly damaged in an accident, and I was getting no information about the leg, then the leg appeared to me to be not mine. It was not only paralyzed and senseless, it was alien. It was just a thing. The imagination could not triumph over this. Again, later when I had a spinal, and I think this is the experience of everyone who has a spinal anesthetic, you feel that you terminate in the middle. And what lies below this sort of forked object of so-called hips and legs is not yours and not anything. And you cannot imagine it back. Again, with Jonathan Eye, the colorblind painter, he thought that his will and imagination and expertise as an artist could just make color. He can't. There's a wonderful poem of D.H. Lawrence in which he says, God can't imagine red. And just one way and another, I'm sort of, in a way, divided between the submission of the imagination to the organic and its transcending the organic in other ways.
Well, Oliver Sacks, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, it's been a great pleasure, Terry.
Neurologist Oliver Sacks, his new book is called An Anthropologist on Mars. The National Book Critics Circle Awards were announced over the weekend. We were delighted to find one of Fresh Air's contributors on the list. Gerald Early won the award for criticism for his book, The Culture of Bruising, Essays on Prize-Fighting Literature and Modern American Culture. Congratulations. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation and Farrer, Straus & Giroux, publisher of Laurie Garrett's The Coming Plague, Newly Emerging Diseases in a World Out of Balance. This is NPR, National Public Radio.